With infinite complacence, people went to and fro over the earth about their little affairs, serene in the assurance of their dominion over this small, spinning fragment of solar driftwood, which by chance or design, man has inherited out of the dark mystery of time and space.
Why don't you ask me what it feels like to be a freak?
Greetings, you are listening to Savage Science Radio here at Jackalope 105 FM, and I am your host, Tracy Savage. We are going to, this week, cover part two of the 2011 Isaac Asimov Memorial Debate on the Theory of Everything. This is where they are asking, can the entire universe be explained with a single unifying theory? This is perhaps the most fundamental question in all of science, and it may be the most controversial. Albert Einstein was among the first to envision a unified theory that could account for the behavior of all matter and energy in the cosmos, but a definitive solution has eluded physicists to this day. As the 21st century progresses, string theory remains the leading candidate to be the theory of everything, although some have come to question whether string theorists are on the right track. Still others doubt that a theory of everything exists at all, and consider the search for such a theory an outdated philosophy of our search for cosmic truths. We are going to join director of the Hayden Planetarium, Neil deGrasse Tyson, as he hosts and moderates six of the world's leading voices in this great scientific debate. And on this panel, Dr. Catherine Fries, Professor of Physics at the University of Michigan, Dr. Jim Gates, Professor of Physics at the University of Maryland College Park, Dr. Jana Levin, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Barnard College, Dr. Marcello Gleiser, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Dartmouth College, Dr. Brian Green, Professor of Physics and Mathematics at Columbia University, and Dr. Lee Smolin, Theoretical Physicist at Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. This talk was recorded at the American Museum of Natural History on March 7th, 2011.
Sure. The endless frontier.
The endless frontier.
And if it's endless, you then can't have a theory of everything.
Right. You make your knowledge grow like an island, you know, but then the shores of ignorance increase.
Yeah, but
is
what...
Is this a question of language?
But Marcello, that sounds like almost wishful thinking. There are things we do understand, and the shoreline of the island does not keep growing. We find another island, but the shoreline of the island we've been studying works. We predict within it, and it doesn't. And we're done. There's certain things about physics that we're done.
We do progress,
but
I mean, we don't progress.
It depends how deep your questions are. Okay, so you say, look, Newtonian gravity explains how, you know, how the Earth is going around the sun, everything is a beautiful thing. And then you start to think, okay, but how is matter attracting matter? Well, you say it's the curvature of space, which is what Einstein said. But then you say, but why matter attracts space?
I'm with you there. I'm with you there, but hear me out. Hear me out.
Okay.
Using that analog, you have Newton that works for, like, horses and stuff. And then Einstein, you need a new understanding that modifies Newton to get high speeds and high gravity, all right? So that's not something separate. That's not a separate island. It's a bigger island with more understanding of the universe, with more tools to measure that fact. I submit to you that it ought to be possible, even likely, that as our tools grow and we discover more things, fine. Then we get to a point where more powerful tools reveal the same phenomenon. And not new phenomena.
How do you know that?
Doesn't that tell you that you hit the limits?
But you can never know that.
Can I try something?
Go.
Because I wouldn't articulate it anything like the way that Marcello does, but I have a disquiet with the dream of the search for the final theory, and let me try to express my disquiet and see if it overlaps see if it addresses your question. Physics, the way that Newton taught us to do it, has a certain methodology. And the methodology is we isolate a little small part of the universe And we do experiments on the small part of the universe over and over and over and over again, varying the inputs, or what we call the initial conditions. And by doing this, we learn to separate out what are the generalities, what is true every time we run the experiment. If the experiment is throwing balls up in the air, we can throw them with different initial speeds, different initial directions, but something is always the same. And those things which are always the same, we call laws, and we separate them from the initial conditions or the inputs to the experiments, which differ. And
this so laws are the things that are constant and repeatable.
They're constant,
in time and space.
Yes, they're constant and repeatable. And this is the method that Newton taught us, and it's highly, highly successful. It explains the success of quantum mechanics, of general relativity, which is always tested, if we're honest, with small parts of the universe and so forth. What is different about the period we live in is that we've come to the cosmological scale. And at the cosmological scale, two things happen simultaneously, which I think befuddle us and I think have thrown us for a loop. One of them is we no longer can do experiments over and over again. There's one experiment, which is the universe as a whole.
Okay. The Big Bang is a singular event.
So we're no longer in this place where we can separate out, quote, the laws from, quote, the initial conditions. That's the first thing that happens. And the other thing that happens is the process that Neil has discussed has worked so well that we're left with the question of not just what are the laws, but why these laws rather than other laws? And why the initial conditions, why it turns out that the initial conditions which give rise to our universe are very special. Why these initial conditions rather than other initial conditions? And at the cosmological scale, the method that Newton taught us to discover what the laws are gives us no grounds or no tool to answer the questions, why these laws, why these initial conditions? And at this point, face a crisis.
Lee, Katie, can't you create initial conditions on a computer and run different universe models? Isn't that tantamount to the same thing?
Yes.
Okay, so here is Lee in his angst that we only have one universe with one set of initial conditions and we're hopeless in a Newtonian sense of being able to experiment with it. But isn't that what you do every day?
No, but we can't understand why these particular laws, why these particular initial conditions.
I think he's heading towards the multiverse.
I'm not heading towards the multiverse.
You are heading
I'll give
the
room. I'll give room for other people.
So
if other people want to use this.
You are
multiverse.
Pushing us towards the multiverse.
No.
Multiverse. Katie, what's the multiverse?
Zip it.
Before we head to the multiverse, okay, I think we're at a junction here. And the junction is, okay, the method that Newton gave us no longer tells us how to go ahead. We have two choices. One of them is to ask, what is the right method to go ahead and continue to do science? We have to change the methodology by which we try to understand the universe. That's the first choice. The second choice is the multiverse. The second choice is to say, well, the method we have only works on systems which are small parts of a much bigger entity, so let's invent a much bigger entity that our universe is a small part of and start to reason in the same way that Newton taught us, statistically and so forth, as if there were many, many, many universes. And my take on the multiverse, even having contributed my own versions of it, is that it's the response to taking Newton's method into a domain where it's not applicable and to failing to have the wisdom to invent a new method which is applicable to discovering what the laws are on a cosmological scale.
I think just because we don't have an answer to a question yet, for example, why are electromagnetic forces as strong as they are today? Just because we can't answer it now doesn't mean that we're not going to get there. I don't want to have to resort to saying, well, our universe has to have this value or we wouldn't exist, and somewhere over there is a different universe that has different creatures because their electromagnetic interactions have a different strength. I don't think so.
So, Lee, I'm going to translate what she just said. She's saying, just because you can't figure it out.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I agree with her.
Doesn't mean the properties of the universe have to be different.
No.
Did I translate accurately there?
I think the conception of laws has to be. Let me quote, for example, the first person to think seriously about the issue that I raised, as far as I know, was the American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce. And he said in 1893 that the progress of science would advance to the point where the problem became not what are the laws, but why these laws. And then he said something I think has a lot of wisdom. He says the only rational way of accounting for why these laws rather than other laws is if the laws themselves are the result of a process of evolution. And I think it's that process of evolution that we have to discover and understand, and then we can do what Katie wants us to do.
Marcelo?
I was just wanted to make a remark before we go into this more philosophical discussion, which is basically we don't even know all the laws. And yes, we're definitely going to make progress. We are always making progress, and there will be answers to many, many questions. But I think it's a process that is not, we should not believe that we should get to an end. You know, I'm for the humility of the humanity. You know, like, yes, we're really smart, but to have the notion that we can find not just all the laws that exist in this universe, but also the laws that define the laws in all possible universes, and hence understand this one in particular, it's quite a which doesn't mean I'm a pessimist. I think we should go there. We should totally try.
But
we should keep in mind that everything should, in the end, be grounded in what we can measure of reality.
But can I just say, Marcelo, that we have had incredibly successful examples of unification. Obviously, certainly, our understanding of matter is more or less unified in an incredibly successful model, where we understand that light isn't different from, electromagnetism isn't different from weak forces or strong forces. Where do you draw the line? I mean, would you have drawn the line before that great success? Would you have said, we have no, we shouldn't be thinking about unification with matter, we'll never get there, and it's just too much to expect?
In other words, Marcelo, 100 years ago, what would you have been saying?
I would have been saying that the unification of electricity and magnetism is not perfect, only in empty space. And that is true. If you look at the equation, sorry about this, guys. If you look at the Maxwell's equations that basically describe how electromagnetic waves propagate in space, they are beautifully perfect, symmetric, whenever you don't have any sources of electricity and magnetism. If you look at, sources, they're not perfect anymore. And just to make a comment about this, yes, we have unified, and I think the tendency of unification, of simplifying our knowledge of nature, is absolutely key. That's what we all want to do. That's what we'd like to do.
But,
and in fact, the standard model, which is what Jana is talking about, is a magnificent achievement in which we can describe everything that we know of particles, in terms of 12 particles. And that's just beautiful. However, it's not a pure unification in the spirit that, say, superstring theory would like it to be, because each one of the forces, electromagnetism, strong, and the weak interactions, keep their imprint in the theory. And what we really want in the so-called grand unified theory or gut theory is that these three things become one. And the standard model certainly does not do that. It's really bringing them together in a sort of a patchwork way. And that is, in fact, one of the reasons why we want to go beyond that. That's one of the motivations for string theory.
Jim, have you gone beyond that?
It's been very interesting sitting on the stage and listening to my colleagues. I am far from experimental physicists, as you can imagine. But this is why experimental...
Which means you're a theorist. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Something like that.
Yeah, okay. That's code for I'm a theorist.
I'm a theorist. Exactly. But my point is that it is always the case that it is our experimental colleagues that prevent us from forming a religion, because it is always grounded in what they can measure, as Marcelo keeps coming back to. And so although people can express either enthusiasm or dismay about where we are at a given point in time, I think that we need to be a little bit more humble and to understand that the process that we engage in is a constant flight from fantasy about what we would want to happen. And we query nature for that, and that query goes through experiment. So although this has probably been very entertaining for my audience here, I think that at the end of the day, we have to keep grounded in it's got to be about things that affect your lives, and those things are measurable things.
So where has this pursuit taken you?
Oh, my God.
Where have you landed?
Why would you ask that?
I'm asking that here and now. It's New York City. It's okay. March 7th.
Well, partly it's taken to these very strange images that are behind your head right now. These are pictures of equations. I've been, for the last 15 years, trying to answer the kinds of questions that my colleagues here have been raising. And what I've come to understand is that there are these incredible pictures that contain all the information of a set of equations that are related to string theory. And it's even more bizarre than that, because when you then try to understand these pictures, you find out that buried in them are computer codes just like the type that you find in a browser when you go surf the web. And so I'm left with the puzzle of trying to figure out whether I live in the Matrix or not.
Wait, you're blowing my mind at this moment. So you're saying, are you saying your attempt to understand the fundamental operations of nature leads you to a set of equations that are indistinguishable from the equations that drive search engines and browsers on our computers?
That is correct. So,
I have to just be silent for a minute here. So you're saying as you dig deeper, you find computer code writ in the fabric of the cosmos?
Into the equations that we want to use to describe the cosmos, yes.
Computer code?
Computer code, strings of bits of ones and zeros.
It's not just sort of resembles computer code, you're saying it is computer code.
It's not even just is computer code, it's a special kind of computer code that was invented by a scientist named Claude Shannon in the 1940s. That's what we find very, very deeply inside the equations that occur in string theory and in general in systems that we say are supersymmetric.
Okay.
Time to go home, I think. I'm not, where are we going to go? Are you saying we are all just, there's some entity that programmed the universe and we're just expressions of their code?
Well, I didn't say that. Some of those
The Matrix? That's what you said.
Some of those codes are showing on the screen behind you right now. They don't look like codes, but these pictures, which we call adinkras, are graphical representations of sets of equations that are based on codes. So this is, in fact, to answer your question more directly, I have, in my life, come to a very strange place because I never expected that the movie The Matrix might be an accurate representation of the place in which I live.
Jim, may I give you an argument that we don't live in The Matrix? Very simple argument. There's a property that the real world right down here has that no mathematical equation has, that no solution of an equation has, that no abstract object has. Here in the real world, it is always some moment, which is one of a series of passing moments. And a mathematical equation doesn't have a flow of time in it. It just is. No, and this means...
But Lee...
Wait, let him finish. Wait, I need him here and now.
This means that to me that the ancient metaphysical fantasy that we, quote, are just mathematics, cannot be true, because in a world that was just mathematics, there would be no moment of time.
Why isn't there math as a function of time?
I'm sorry.
We solve those. These are differential equations.
But then you lay the solution out.
You're mistaking. You keep using the word is, and I'm talking about the word describe. You see,
let me finish, please,
we started with my discussion. The point is that it's fun to talk about some deep metaphysical essence that sits behind physics. But for some of us, it's about trying to find the most accurate way to describe where we live. And so my statement is that in the description of our universe, that is a supersymmetrical universe, which we were going to test in the LHC. If you believe that description, I can show you the presence of these codes. That's my statement.
That's beautiful, and that's fine. And I admire that. That seriously, that's fine. That's another beautiful piece of mathematics that may be explanatory or descriptive of physics. But that all I'm objecting to is that doesn't mean that we live in the mathematics. That means the mathematics is just descriptive of an aspect of the universe.
Let me follow that one up, Jim. Just because who was it? Eugene Wigner, who commented on the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics that we just invent in our head, yet the universe follows, can be described mathematically. Mathematics is the language of the universe. Brian, math is your tool. So should we be amazed or depressed by what Jim tells us here?
I can't really comment on what Jim says. I found myself in the unusual position of feeling rather conservative on a panel when usually I'm sort of at the outside.
And by the way, the pictures Jim showed all look like spirograph images.
Yeah, I saw them. I
from
saw
your
them,
kids
and I
thing.
Don't know enough about them to comment. But there is an interesting question, the one that you raise, about whether math is descriptive of the universe, or we are the math, or what's the role of math? Do you discover it is invented? I mean, I had a conversation, and I think you may have been involved in it, if not mistaken. The question was, you know, is math the right way of going about trying to find deep physical law? And I said, look, I can imagine one day we'll encounter aliens, and they'll say to us, okay, show us what you've got to describe the universe. We break out our mathematics, and they look at it and they say, oh, math, we used to do that. Ultimately, a dead end, you know, and then they show us what they have found. Now, the problem with that is I don't actually even know what I would fill in regarding what they would show us, because to me, mathematics is really the language of pattern. It's self-consistent ways of embodying pattern, and that's ultimately what we do. We're pattern recognition machines. We try to codify the patterns we see in the world around us in math, and in that way, we try to describe the universe around us. Does that mean we are the mathematics? I don't know. It becomes really hard to really know exactly what that means, but we have found that math, so far, is a potent tool for making predictions that we can test and confirm. And that's why I follow this particular trajectory.
Brian, we're going to have to very shortly go to questions from the audience. But I want to come back at you with a couple of questions that are sort of purposefully blunt. Okay?
Yeah.
Sure. So you guys have been at this string theory for running on two decades now. And Einstein, working alone, went from special relativity to general relativity in 10 years, working alone. And and it was a brilliant piece of work, and there was an experimental verification 4 years after he came up with the idea. Here you have legions of string theorists working two decades, and you're sort of not there yet. Is there just not enough of you? Are you chasing a ghost? Or are the collection of you just too stupid to figure this out?
I mean, I think it's pretty clear it's the latter. You know? look, you know, Einstein was a singular genius, and making comparisons with him, I think, is perhaps not that representative. But putting that to the side, look, the questions that Einstein was trying to resolve, however deep they were still within a realm that was experimentally accessible within a couple of years, a couple decades at most. We are ambitious, and we are trying to make a big leap to try to understand the universe on fantastically small scales and fantastically high energies. Why are we so ambitious? Because we have been so successful theoretically to date that the open questions in this line of research are the ones that we're now focused upon. They're much harder to test, and therefore we don't have the guidance of experiment to nudge us this way or that as much as in the past. Now, if we could solve these questions, I think we'd be answering some of the deep mysteries of the ages. Do you say, well, you haven't cracked it in 20 years, so it's time to give up? No, I think you say, if progress stalls, then you go and look at other directions. But as long as progress is carrying forward, and it is, you keep going and try to figure things out.
I think your pace of progress is sufficiently slow that it has led to these other ideas exhibited on this panel.
Well,
because you're slow,
you,
that
you
Jim
know,
is finding you know, that we live in a matrix. And that, to, and that know, Marcelo get, is questioning the whole idea of a unified theory.
Yeah, so I do worry about some of the things said on the stage maybe giving the wrong impression. But the bottom line is this. You have no capacity, as far as I know, to judge progress in the field unless you're actually deeply reading the theoretical papers in the journals. Are you doing that?
No. Yeah, well, I presume members of I presume that we got people here who that's why I brought the panel here. That's why I brought this panel here. And apparently they're thinking up other stuff now because string theory is not satisfying them on some level.
Look, let me just say this. We have made great progress, and that I really think is not disputable. Have we solved all the key questions? Have we tested the theory? Those are the most vital things. No, but you know, we've united gravity and quantum mechanics, at least on paper. On paper, we've unified all the four forces. we've incorporated key breakthroughs from the past that are now well understood within the context of string theory. We've been able to cure space-time singularities of particular sorts within string theory. We've understood black hole entropy within string theory. The mathematical contributions of string theory are absolutely unassailable. Time and time again, we've had great contributions. So to say there's no progress, come on, man, that's just not right.
Okay, okay. While people gather to the microphones at the front of the stage, let me just get a quick reaction to Brian. Jana, we haven't heard from you in a bit. Quick reaction to Brian.
Well, you know, I
invite you to come to the microphones.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Brian, mostly because his office is three doors down from mine. I agree with Brian in the sense that progress is being made, but we all have to pursue other directions. Occasionally, think in a different direction than I can't say string theory is the mainstream, but then the flow of ideas, there's always going to be new ideas that come on the table. I don't think you can judge progress in terms of human scales. There's nowhere is it written that we have to solve problems in one human lifetime, that we won't have to work on problems for hundreds of years. This might be the first time that it's really been documented like this, but I don't see why we should be shocked that solving incredibly challenging problems may take more than one human lifespan.
And I confess, Brian, in spite of my diatribe there, I agree with Jaina. There were some problems in the history of astronomy that took millennia to solve. So I'm getting on your case.
Neil, come on, man. Give me a hug.
See, I can just unplug you, you see. I've got real power here. Katie, where are you on this?
Supersymmetry. We haven't talked a lot about supersymmetry, which is an important ingredient in string theory, and there are aspects to it that come over to cosmology and are extremely testable.
So these are extra particles added to the model that we have for particle physics that explain some stuff that right now we can't explain.
For every particle we know about, there's a new partner. So, for example, for the electron, there would be the selectron.
Selectron.
Selectron with the S, the supersymmetry in the front.
Cool.
Or the photon becomes a photino.
Okay.
And all of these particles decay to lighter ones, decay, 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 until at the end you get to the very lightest supersymmetrical particles, and those could be the dark matter. In fact, they're the strongest candidates for dark matter, and one of the major motivations for building the LHC, so the LHC can find
dark matter particles.
Yes, and supersymmetry. And then dark matter detectors are currently, they're underground underneath the Apennines in Italy. They're all over the world. They're in deep underground mines in the United States. And they're looking for supersymmetric particles to scatter off of the detector. And then you look for that little bit of heat deposit. And every single one of these experiments that has happened in the last few years has seen anomalous, unexplained results. So
that could all come together.
Yes.
Soon.
So maybe Elena Aprile at Columbia University. She's the leader of the xenon experiment, and they're going to release data very soon, and that's the best bet that we're going to solve this problem.
And then you're in business. Then it's no longer an exotic particle.
If supersymmetry is right, well, that is one of the key ingredients in the building of string theory.
Marcello.
However, if you look at the data coming out of the LHC in the last 2 months, it's restricting the parameter space of supersymmetry.
Not much. No,
a whole
it's
lot.
Not. No.
I would say it's
misleading. Their abstract is misleading.
You're both interpreting the same research paper differently.
Yeah, yes. Obviously.
Yeah. Jim?
Well, all I want to say is that you need to understand that a large part of the discussion here tonight, in fact, reminds me of the story about the blind man and the elephant. You know, mm-hmm. They each feel a different part and think it's a different creature. I have a sense that that's likely what's going on in a lot of the discussion.
That the universe is an elephant.
Well, yes, and that
written
we're blind.
We're blind.
And so the thing that I told you about information, ultimately that would actually become part of string theory, not something different. If string theory is correct, this will be part of it.
I want to go to the audience right now. In order to make this efficient, because we're a little long, you direct your question just to one of the panelists, not to, look, can I get a comment from all eight of you? No, one panelist, and we'll be try to be efficient in your answers. Go.
All right, this one's...
I remember this. He was a little kid coming to Hayden program. I don't even recognize him. Aren't you in college yet?
Yeah, MIT.
MIT. He's at MIT. Well, congratulations. He's been coming since he couldn't even walk.
This one's to
Wait, shouldn't you be in school now? Okay.
This one's to Gates, with apologies to Robert Frost. Some say the world would be written in Perl, some say in Lisp. But that aside...
You better apologize again to Robert Frost on that one.
You better watch out. He's at MIT right now.
Yeah. I'll see you there.
I'll be looking for you in the infinite corridor.
Blame the admissions office. Anyway, are there any... Do you have any predictions in your ideas or any ways to test any of your ideas any more than, say, the guy over on the screen?
Well, first you can take the blue pill or the red pill, and you'll find out.
I took the red pill. The work that I'm doing is, in fact, so theoretical that we don't understand yet whether it is even possible to complete the program. We have found these strange graphs. We know that they are equivalent to equations, and we have found in these equations computer codes. And so that's where we are right now. So I cannot give you a prediction. This work is less than 2 years old.
But it's not that you never... You recognize that you will need a prediction in order to...
Someone recently asked me, said, well, you don't care about experiments, do you? And I said, no, that's exactly wrong. Because, you see, I have spent my career as a researcher worrying about supersymmetry. I would want to see an experiment before I shuffle off this mortal coil, so that I know that I did not waste my entire professional life.
We're good with that. Okay. Right here.
I guess my question's for Lee. It seemed like towards the end you were talking about coming to a point where either you change the science or you go to multiverse theory, and it almost seemed like you were called out by Kate as though... oh, no, not multiverse theory, like it's a cop-out. And is it or is it not? And that's really what I want to know. I want to hear a little bit more about that from you on that.
So is a multiverse a cop-out?
My view is that it doesn't, and there are so many things that we've mentioned here that we could have a long discussion of at very different levels. So, but my view is that it's very unlikely that the kind of multiverses which have a larger infinite number of universes existing simultaneously with no common chains of descent, it's very unlikely that those will lead to testable predictions that are successful. And I know that there's disagreement.
That doesn't mean that's not true.
No, no, no.
Okay.
Science is not about what's true or what might be true. Science is about what people with originally diverse viewpoints can be forced to believe by the weight of public evidence. So... Sorry.
I got to give him a applause. That was good. That was good.
Okay. So my view is that if... And this is, I should confess, in work with Roberto Mangibera Unger, which is in progress, and it's also inspiring a lot of my current scientific work. I'm interested in the idea that the universe is just that which we see already most of, and taking seriously Charles Sanders Peirce's maxim, which I did in my first book, Life of the Cosmos, was proposing a cosmological scenario in which the explanation for why these laws did arise through a process akin to natural selection, and thinking about that more seriously and more deeply in the last few years, it leads me to think a lot about the nature of time and the question of whether time is emergent, as many people in the quantum gravity world have proposed, or whether just space is emergent and time, in some sense, is really, really real, is not emergent, and whether if laws evolve and time is really, really real, whether there are new opportunities to do plain old-fashioned science, the way that Katie was saying, there's science where we make predictions and we widen our understanding and we widen our knowledge because we're able to make predictions which are verified successfully. So that's in a nutshell.
That wasn't a nutshell. That was a coconut shell or something.
Okay. Anyway, thank you.
Sure. Next question here.
Okay, first I feel like maybe a little emotional closure on the debate. If you could kiss the back of his video head. Anyway, the question is just for fun, and if anyone wants to answer it, maybe no one does. Sort of in the spirit of Isaac Asimov. So forgetting LHC, forgetting even xenon experiment, if there's something that you could go to and measure, forgetting the continuity of space-time, what might you measure to get the deepest insight that you might want to see about the universe? Does that make sense?
Sure.
Let me go to Marcelo. Marcelo, you take that.
Jeez. I'd like to see gravitons. If I could see a graviton, then I would be for sure convinced that gravity has to be described quantum mechanically. Because you see, right now, we are so confused about what gravity is all over again that there are some proposals out there that gravity may not be a force like the other forces, which goes very much against the spirit of superstrings. And so if we saw a graviton and were a quantum particle like a photon, that would be great. And if we're a chiral graviton, then that man would be a very happy man.
So it's not good enough just to see a gravitational wave. You want to get the actual particle in there,
yes,
is what you're saying. Next question here, sure.
I guess I could aim my question to Dr. Green. When does the abstract become too abstract, where you can't even possibly, let's say, explain to the layman? I'm a biochemistry student. I took 2 semesters of physics and read, you know, some stuff on the side. I thought I'd be prepared for a talk like this tonight. I am abhorrently unprepared.
Okay, so Brian, why don't you take that?
Well, you know, I think it's vital to explain these ideas in a way that someone without technical training can understand, simply because it's so enormously exciting what's happening at the frontier, and it's a shame when it's couched in language that many people aren't trained to understand. But in terms of scientific research and the progress that we make in one field or another, I don't think you judge it by how abstract it is. You judge it by how well it contributes to trying to solve unsolved problems, how well it contributes to trying to make predictions that you might be able to one day confirm. And, you know, look, it could be that the final laws are right out there staring us in the face, frankly, and we don't have the mental capacity to understand it. So it may not be that we're coming up with ideas that are too abstract. The universe may have fundamental truths that we can't grasp. I mean, look, you know, dogs are pretty smart, but I don't know any dogs that know the general theory of relativity.
Okay. That's it. So plus, of course, Brian has the most successful books written on this subject ever. They were bestsellers, so somebody's buying them who are not scientists. And so there's some major fraction of the reading public that does receive the language, the translated language that Brian provides us. Next question. Yes.
Yes, I'm one of those people who's not a scientist that reads these books. I'm a philosopher. And my question is directed to Lee, since he's grappled with philosophical issues more than anyone else I'm aware of. I was particularly enchanted by the trouble with physics and the earlier book, The Life of the Cosmos. Lee, how much of the problems that physicists are now dealing with in attempting to unify all the different theories of the physical forces, how much of that is as a result of a lack of a conceptual understanding of, shall we say, philosophical insight? How much of it is due to being tied to an empiricist outlook?
That's an interesting question.
That, for instance, the old Newtonian paradigm that there are things out there in the world and relations are something separate from things.
Well, just so I understand. Yeah. Is it fair to reword your question in the following way, just because I can believe I understand it? You're saying sometimes it's good to be driven by a philosophical expectation of what you would expect the universe to be, and that guides your experiment. And another way is just doing an experiment without a philosophy.
Well, something like that. But what I'm saying is that maybe our conceptual apparatus is sometimes that we inherit from our day-to-day experience is simply not adequate for grasping modern physics.
So I'm going to say 2 things that appear to contradict themselves.
And try to make this really in a nutshell.
Okay. Science progresses because there's a diversity of scientists who have a diversity of viewpoints, predilections. Some of us are very pragmatic and empirical. Some of us are conversant with the philosophical literature and the historical literature, and I think it's important for the diversity for science that there be diverse approaches and as well as diverse styles. Okay. I also think it's the case that we're coming out of a period which was dominated by a very pragmatic tradition, okay, which followed a period that was very philosophical. That is, the physicists who dominated the early part of the 20th century were largely people conversant with the philosophical tradition. And they achieved great things, like the discovery of quantum mechanics and general relativity. And then they started to fail to achieve things. And the pragmatic generation that came after them achieved great things that they failed to achieve, epitomized by people like Richard Feynman and Freeman Dyson. And now maybe we're in a period where we face again questions where we need people who are conversant with the philosophical tradition. But the most important thing is that the only thing that matters is real results that make contact with experiments. It doesn't matter how we get there. And therefore, the diversity of approaches is the most important thing for progress.
It's a good theme in many walks of life, actually. Next question here.
So I'll address this to Dr. Green on the television, because you talked about our ability to grasp. I wonder to what extent do the limits, our cognizance of the limits of logic, and this is a physics question, not a religious question, do we take that into account in our attempt to understand phenomena? Do we ever think that they might be beyond the limits of logic, since we are, after all, embedded in the universe? And also, whatever happened to the anthropic principle?
Yeah.
Well, you know, for the first question, we theorists all work within the framework of mathematics, which itself is based upon the logical structure within which the fundamental operations are constructed. So we really don't sit at our desks and counter a problem and say, maybe this is beyond logic. We say, maybe this is beyond the mathematical formalism that we so far built. Maybe this is beyond the theoretical ideas we so far developed. And we try to push them, but all within the context of traditional logic, within the context of traditional mathematics. There are some people who push the boundaries and really do fiddle with some of the logical axioms to see where that may lead. But that's really not a mainstream activity among theoretical physicists. As far as the anthropic principle goes, well, you know, that's this idea that we really touched on with these multiverse notions that came up a little bit in the conversation. I'm surprised, frankly, it didn't come up more in the conversation, because this is really where string theory has gone, and it's too late in the evening to go into it in great detail. But one thing that you really do have to bear in mind, when we observe the universe, our observations are biased. They're biased by the fact that we are here doing those observations. And we have to take into account that observational bias. There are things that we simply could not see, because to see them, we'd have to exist in a place that would be so inhospitable to our makeup that we couldn't actually be there. And that really is what the anthropic idea is about, taking that into consideration. And that is something which is something that needs to be done across the board in science.
So a takeaway from you, Brian, there is that before you start abandoning the very foundations of logic, there's still much more to bring us from the field of mathematics in our search for truth in the universe.
Yeah, there's no evidence that we need to abandon logic.
Yeah,
I was just going to say quickly that there are examples in science, particularly last century, where we did confront decided limits in physics and in mathematics. So Gödel and Turing, for instance, were the mathematicians that realized that there were facts among numbers that we will never know, that it was an actual fundamental limit in the context of arithmetic. There were true facts among numbers that we would never know, and not only that, but most numbers were numbers about which we would never know anything. And there was also the limit of the speed of light and maybe the limit of uncertainty in Heisenberg's understanding of quantum mechanics. And out of each of these things came incredibly creative scientific bursts. They were not the end of understanding, but they just squeezed all of that energy into a different direction. So from the limit of the speed of light, we discover special relativity. From Heisenberg's limit, we discover quantum mechanics. From Gödel and Turing, we delve into computer technology and artificial intelligence. So confronting limitations isn't necessarily an end. It's often a creative kind of beginning.
That's a brilliant point. Thanks for adding that. Yes. We'll go about another 7 minutes here. Are we okay in the audience? A reminder that at the end of this, the panel will be out in the Hall of Northwest Coast Indians, and you can bring your program, have them sign it, or I think there are books there for sale as well. So we'll take this another 7 minutes. So try to be efficient. We'll get through as many of you as possible. Go ahead.
How far do we take?
Well, who's this to?
I guess Mr. Green, but anybody who...
okay, go on. Mm-hmm.
How far do we take the analogy with musical strings? They talk about
We got to take that to Brian. Brian, you were on TV talking about string theory with a string quartet in the background. Is that that seems like a stretch to me. What? How about?
But in particular, I was wondering what causes the vibration in these little particles, and is it the Big Bang and one proton extra and the asymmetry created, or, and also, you were talking about 10 dimensions coming. Is that coming from the 10 directions that the string vibrates, and how did they find those?
Yeah. So, very briefly, I know that time is short. We didn't really say what string theory is, strangely, in this whole conversation. The idea is that the heart of matter are little tiny vibrating string-like filaments, and that's why we call it string theory. And as to the analogy with musical instruments, violins, and cellos, this is one of the places in physics where the analogy brushes up very, very closely with the real physics. Were I to show you the equations governing the motions of the little strings in string theory and the equations governing the motion of a violin string, there are some very direct resonances between those mathematical equations. So this is a metaphor that really is, unlike many, right on target. In terms of what causes the strings to vibrate, that is, where does their energy come from, I don't know. That basically is the question, where is the energy in the universe coming from? Why is there something, in essence, rather than nothing? We don't know the answer. We look out in the universe, we see that there is energy. If string theory is correct, a big if, but if it's correct, then the strings would be the most fundamental microscopic carriers of that energy, and they would carry it in their vibrational patterns.
Okay. Brian, had I known you didn't know why strings vibrate, I mean, I don't know if I'm disappointed that you don't know this.
Just be careful with your way you summarize what I said.
Okay. I'll try. Next, right here.
Towards Dr. Gates, I'm curious about your theory. You say there's computer code in these equations. Now, computer code is generally just instructions for a processor, and I'm curious as to what the instructions you're finding are, and if you're not sure, what's to say that it's actually computer code? I mean, theoretically, the number pi has all the data that's ever existed.
Well, we say that they're computer codes.
You mean the digits in pi?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. We say they're computer codes, first of all, because the structure of the equation is such that they dictate that there are certain things that are actually strings of ones and zeros. That's just digital data. But it's not just random ones and zeros. As I mentioned earlier, let me talk about something that you probably do every day, but I don't know if you're a computer scientist or not. Most of us sit at our...
Sounds that kind of fluency, I suppose.
Okay, well, most of us sit at our computer screens and we type on the keyboards, and we then send these, if we're using a browser, we're sending strings of ones and zeros elsewhere. But on the other hand, in the transmission process, there's always some fluctuation. So zero that you type here because of static in line might be read as a one at the other end and vice versa. And so in fact, when you sit and type on the keyboard, your computer's doing something behind your back. Namely, it throws in a bunch of extra ones and zeros, which and these things are called error correcting codes, so that the computer at the other end can look at the whole collection of what you type plus what was sent and figure out if there were bits that were being flipped back and forth. And that's how you get accurate transmission of digital data. Among the codes that are used for this purpose are a special class of codes that are called block linear self-dual error correcting codes. They were first, in fact, the Shannon extended checksum code is an example of one of these things. These are the codes that we find buried in the equations. Not just any code, but these self-dual error correcting block codes. It's quite remarkable for anyone that I've talked to. We have no idea what these things are doing there.
Any literature out?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any literature out that...
I can give you technical references that almost nobody in the world can understand.
But Jim, I thought you had a popular level article on this?
Thank you. Yes, actually, so this past June, the British journal Physics World asked me to write a popular level description of what we have found. So in the June edition of Physics World, and it's published in London, the cover story is called Symbols of Power. It's about these weird symbols that have been showing behind us. We call these things adinkras. And so for a popular level description, yes, we've written that. But other than this one popular level description, it's all technical gobbledygook. Wonderful. And that's a technical term, by the way.
Gobbledygook.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. We're only going to have time for two more questions. I've just been cute. But you'll be one of them. So come on up to the microphone. Sure.
Okay. Yeah. Hopefully this isn't, like, overly stupid question or uninformed, but I'm just curious whether...
I bet it's not. I'm going to bet you. Yeah.
Thank you. But I'm wondering whether, like, the quantum fluctuations, like random particles, like popping into existence and out of existence, whether that would be, whether that could possibly be explained by particles moving through other dimensions into, say, a plane that we exist in, and if that's impossible, can you explain why?
Not only was that a good question, you're making everyone else in this room feel stupid. I just want you to know, okay? Just so you know. All right. So, who wants to volunteer for that one?
Katie,
you want to hit that? Virtual particles coming in and out, is that another dimension talking to us?
Well, we definitely know that particles pop in and out of existence. It happens everywhere all the time. And this gets back to this is what people think might be responsible for the dark energy. Only the problem is when you do the calculation, it comes out wrong by 10 to the 120th power, the 120 in the exponent. So in fact, there's much too much of this fluctuation going on in our calculations. So if you're going to include the amount in the other dimensions, it's not going to help. So I don't think that's a very good answer to your question, but this is at the heart of one of the deepest problems in all of physics.
Marcelo, so,
not a stupid question.
I just wanted to add that, yes, theories with extra dimensions, when there are certain properties of these extra dimensions that they oscillate in certain ways, they can produce particles in four dimensions that we can actually detect, called pergons, I think. Sort of an old idea.
Gurdons?
P-Y-R-G-O-N-S, right?
Pergons?
Pergons.
Gons. That sounds like creatures out of Star Trek or something.
So yes, the presence of extra dimensions create certain particles in four dimensions, or could create. I don't know if they're electrons, but they could be there.
Okay, I think we have the last question here. Welcome.
This is again touching on mathematics, and the question is, to what extent are our systems of mathematics and measurements subjective or objective, invented or discovered? Gödel, of course, talks about incomplete systems, but Einstein says, as far as the laws of mathematics refer to reality, they are not certain, and as far as they are certain, they do not refer to reality. Any comments?
Yeah, Jaina, why don't you take that?
Well,
this is what you've been working on. Which gives you the final comments.
I'm still working on it. The interesting thing about Gödel is that he really was a strict Platonist. He actually believed that mathematical forms had concrete objective existence. This world he wasn't so sure about. He wasn't really sure if his ordinary experience was of created by his own mind, and he really had breaks with reality, but he did believe in transmigration of the soul and the idea that he would get closer and closer to a Platonic reality where it would all be perfect circles, pi, you know, irrational numbers. And I think it's hard for most of us to follow that particular philosophy. I think that there is no simple answer to whether or not mathematics is the objective reality. I mean, Lee sort of brought up this idea that maybe it's just a description, but one which could never completely encapsulate. Did you say that, or am I projecting?
Yes.
Could never completely encapsulate physical reality. I mean, I think it's difficult to make a philosophical determination. I believe in being a bad philosopher, and at times being a complete objective realist in terms of mathematics when it's convenient, at times not being. But what seems to be true is that functionally, it's incredibly powerful. Functionally, it continues to work, and so we continue to pursue the ramifications of mathematizing the universe.
I want to live in a world with irrational numbers and rational people. let's end with just, in 10 years, where is string theory going to be, or TOEs? 2021, where is it going to be? We're going to come right on down, and we'll end the evening. Go.
But you know, I hope we have a quantum theory of gravity, whether it's string theory or not, and I hope that there is experimental test of it and verification of it. I think it could be one of several approaches, maybe loop quantum gravity, maybe causal dynamical triangulations, and maybe string theory, and we shall see. This is science, which means we don't know the answer.
Will we see it in 10 years?
Yes.
Good. How about you?
I think
2021.
I think it's a great time to be a scientist. We have great experiments on the horizon. We're going to see space ringing in gravitational waves. We have the Large Hadron Collider, and we have great mysteries. We know there are things we don't know. You know, there's dark matter, dark energy. We know we haven't unified all the forces. So we have great mysteries. We have tools to approach those answers. I'm pretty optimistic that some of the pieces of the puzzle.
So the known unknowns are quite striking.
Yeah.
Are there any unknown unknowns out here? You will know, of
you're
course.
Confusing me.
Marcel, 10 years from now.
So, yes, I think that at least in 10 years we'll have excellent data to possibly either confirm or rule out supersymmetry and also know if the Higgs particle, which we also did not mention tonight, exists
or
not.
The famous God particle giving mass to all the other particles, right?
Right. It actually used to be called the goddamn particle, you know, because they can't find it. So that's what Leon Lederman, who wrote this book, The God Particle, said. His real title was The Goddamn Particle, but the editor didn't like it.
The editor changed it, yeah.
So anyway, so I'm optimistic in the sense that we'll have the data. I am very skeptical with notions that our ideas, you know, when they go too far, always have something to do with nature. That this sort of extreme Platonism worries me a lot.
All right, Jim, 10 years, where are we?
Well, first of all, Marcello just actually took my answers. I think in 10
okay,
years...
Okay, should we skip you?
Yes.
That works. No, seriously.
Oh, you're not serious, though. I think that, well, in my pessimistic moments, I think in 10 years, string theory is not going to be complete. Because what's going to have to happen is a genius is going to have to appear, and that doesn't occur on anybody's time clock. We actually are going to need...
So you're agreeing that the whole community is just not smart enough to figure it out.
No, because such people do appear.
No, but right now, all the people who have been working on it aren't smart enough. That's what you're saying.
No,
because saying?
Given time, one of them might actually be that genius.
Okay.
So in my darker moments, I think in 10 years, we are not going to have what Lee will probably be happy to hear, which is a background independent description of string theory. I think that's the absolute most important thing to find.
Okay. Katie, 10 years, 2021.
Dark matter, yes. Dark energy, we'll know a little bit more. Higgs, yeah, probably.
Again, the particle that gives mass to all other particles.
The goddamn particle,
yeah. The
gravitational waves, good bet. So a lot of the data are going to come roaring in, but is this going to prove or disprove string theory? Probably not.
Okay. Just give us a better understanding of the 4% plus the dark matter, not the dark energy.
And the supersymmetry, which is an important ingredient.
Okay.
And possibly these the things Lee was talking about, these tensor modes, will tell you perhaps about something coming from the string epoch. So there's some hints there.
Brian, we're giving you the last word here because you had the first word. You're going to close this out. 10 years from now, 2021, where are you?
Well, look, here's my feeling. I really enjoy these Asimov debates. And to secure my place at the 20th anniversary Asimov debate, I'm going to hold back my answer until then.
Join me in thanking the marvelous panel. Asimov panelists, thank you, one and all.
Don't know if I'm going to get cut off here, but happy trails until we meet again. This has been Savage Science Radio. Bye-bye now.